All right, welcome everybody. Today is Wednesday, January 11th, 2023, and this is our first research roundtable of the year. And I know you guys love technical topics, so I brought everyone's.
I don't usually.
Everyone's favorite technical colonel, Colonel Sean Sanders. No, Colonel Sean Smith. All right, Colonel Sean Smith is here today. I asked Sean, he said, what would you like me to talk about? I said, yes, whatever technical topic you want, because we're due for a technical topic. So everybody's ready. So take it away, Sean.
So I thought maybe we could talk about one or two things that came to mind because they're very timely. And I think they affect a lot of jurisdictions. And so the issues are really important. Both of them are sort of related to Arizona, but they have applications in lots of other places. So let me just open up the question. I thought the two things that we could talk about, we could either try to do a little bit of a deep dive on Runbeck as a exemplar, but also as one of the largest printers of ballots in the country that prints mail-in ballots, or automated signature verification, which Runbeck is involved in. And I thought we could talk about some of the issues involved in automatic signature verification and why nobody should be using it and why everything we've been told about it is a farce and a lie. Or we could talk about kind of a combination of those. Does anybody have a preference? Anybody want to chime in with something timely? I think this affects a lot of places. This is being pushed by NASA, NACID, and EAC as something viable. And also, as part of that, I want to talk about this whole paper shortage idea that is being pimped repeatedly, kind of like climate alarmism. So any thoughts or preferences from the forum?
I'm going to, this is Dave from Washington. I'm going to vote with Amy and say yes.
Okay. I don't know, Sean, you think you can fill an hour and a half just talking about these? I think we might need a part two and a part three, really.
I think there's also going to be information that people have in their own states. Like what happens usually is you start talking about these things. This happens with forensic groups. You know, you start talking, and we can talk about some of the specifics of what's happened in Maricopa and what the, I don't even know what to say. Yesterday, I went to Elbert County, Colorado, and watched a couple real public servants get sworn in for their terms as commissioner and clerk. And the judge who swore them in is the same judge who ruled against that commissioner when he was the county clerk there and forced him to turn over the copies of election records he had made to the Secretary of State, who destroyed all the other copies of election records. And this is, we're finding this kind of, I don't know what to call it, judicial malpractice, corruption, I don't know what to call it. But anyway, a lot of these issues came up there with signature verification and, you know, what's true. And so watching what happened in Maricopa and what that judge, what the Tucci, the judge in the first Lake v. Hobbs case, and then the latest judge, and just watching them consider sanctions after they have ruled so just spectacularly, you know, ineptly, which is charitable in those cases. But I thought we could talk about some of what happened in Maricopa, the evidence that was presented, the difference between, you know, what we were told in the media, the kind of narrative that was pimped by the media about how Runbeck helped Maricopa save the day, and then what's actually true based on the evidence that we could see there in Maricopa. So I mean, we can fold all of that in. I guess I should just launch in. So let's if it's everybody's okay with it, unless there's somebody else with a, somebody's got their hand up. Does somebody have a, is it Laura in Iowa? Do you have a preference, Laura?
Hi, Sean. Thank you everybody for being here. Happy New Year. Yeah, I agree with, we have a hot mess with the signature verification here in Iowa. If there is a mark, they tell us if there is a mark on the line, it's good. You can't compare signature. They use the explanation as we are not trained signature verifiers. Therefore, if there's a mark, it's good. If there's not a mark, then some, you know, there's no signature. That's it. And so that's a hot mess. So where do we go from there? right? There's all kinds of people all over the United States who have jobs where they have to verify signatures every day, and they're not trained in signature verification. So it's just, it's ridiculous. They set us up for this. So yeah, it's a great topic. All of it is. Thank you.
Yeah, that is exactly right. Let me see if I've got these things here. Some people have seen me show these. So where do I have this? I'm trying to find the original. So, you know, a ballot signature, a normal ballot, not a ballot signature, but a ballot envelope signature. So hold on just a second. Let me close this door. My dog's going to keep running in. All the dogs in the house are in trouble today. One of them got into the trash last night, and the other two had a fight this morning. So they're all in the literal doghouse. There's I was trying to figure out how so many signatures were accepted. And then I started researching the signature verification process, because I've told people, but they don't sometimes believe me or understand the magnitude of my ignorance. When I started this whole process, I didn't know how anything happened. I didn't know how they did anything in the election process. I only knew you marked your ballot and then they counted it, you know, with integrity and accurately, and everybody got their ballot counted once after their identity was verified and they submitted their cast ballot, and all of that was, of course, wrong. But I started looking at the signature process. And normally when you see a signature affidavit on the mail-in ballot envelope, which is typically where it is, and sometimes it's inside a security envelope so that those are protected, but a lot of states are increasingly not using any kind of security envelope and the signature is exposed, which means that when the ballots go through mail processing, they're scanned by the Postal Service. So the Postal Service scans all first-class mail and all election related mail. And because they do that, because most ballot envelopes that are being sent out and returned for mail-in and early ballots have an intelligent mail barcode on it, well, that IMB, that intelligent mail barcode, which is the weird looking multi-height barcode on the outside of mail, that correlates to a specific customer, including routing information, you know, origin and destination information, and metadata for that mail piece and for all of those mail pieces. And all of that metadata plus the images are available and typically forwarded to the customer that is the owner per se of the intelligent mail barcode. So for example, in your state, let's pick a state like Washington state, they may have IMBs that correlate to the Secretary of State's office for the mail going out and to a specific county for the mail coming back in. And then they are signed up as the owner, and I'm trying to remember the name of the process owner, but basically they own the account within U.S. Postal Service's mail track and report. It's track and report, MTR. And so they get data that tells them the status of every mail piece, where it was last scanned, where it's on its way to, where it originated, and they get those images when the mail pieces are scanned if they want them. They can also designate proxies. So when you see a service like Ballot Tracks, they are getting proxy data from the Postal Service on the status of those mail pieces. It's also typically interfaced with the statewide voter registration system. So when voters are getting texts or emails saying your ballot has been printed, your ballot has been mailed, your ballot has been counted, well, when they're told their ballot has been received, accepted, or counted, there's no way for there to be an interface between the ballot being counted and that notification system unless they are violating the law. So what they're really doing is saying that they've received the piece, and then they're telling voters that their ballot has been counted. So they're giving them kind of a false assurance, but what's new? But let me share my screen. I want to show you something. So I've found in no state where mail-in ballots are used and the affidavit signatures are used for verification of the identity, in no state are judges who are looking at those manually being given the instruments to see what they should be able to see. So not in every state, but in almost every state, it's illegal to have a machine or another individual. It says that the voter themselves must sign the affidavit right? So typically when we have someplace where there's notary that's required or something like that, they have to make a special provision to specifically and explicitly allow for the use of electronic signatures. A printed signature printed by a machine, including an inkjet printer, except in cases typically where the individual is somehow disabled or differently enabled or whatever the correct, politically correct term is, except in those cases, they are not supposed to be using any kind of machine for the signature. So if you find an inkjet printed signature, it is evidence prima facie of an illegal, unacceptable affidavit, and therefore the ballot should be not be counted. But no jurisdiction anywhere is checking for this, which means that you could, and I'll tie this back into Redbeck because it's ludicrous and alarming, but which means that because we give companies like Runbeck not only the ballot formats and the information to put on the mailing envelopes for early and mail-in ballots, but also access to the voter information, because when they're running an automatic signature verification machine, by default, in order to be able to compare the signatures on envelopes to the signatures in the database, they have to have access to the database, which means they have access to the signatures to begin with. So let me do the math here. One company has ballot formats, and by the way, they can print test decks, and they do, which means they can print marked ballots. They also have systems that are used for ballot duplication, like if you have UOCAVA, overseas voters, or if they have spoiled ballots, they can duplicate a ballot, meaning they can print a ballot with ballot choices, vote choices marked. And they even have a system to print the marks so that the marks don't look artificial. In other words, they have a library of images, and so does Dominion, and so does ESNS. They have a library of ballot mark images that look like handwritten or hand-marked ballot marks. To the naked eye, they look like they've been made by hand with a pen. And they can use their printers to print these. So let me go back to Runbeck now. Runbeck has printers which print ballots, ballot envelopes, ballot marks, and they have access to all the signatures for many jurisdictions, sometimes entire states, which they can also print on the outside of ballot envelopes. So Runbeck, one single company, has every single piece of information it needs to print a marked ballot for any voter in some states and jurisdictions, and then to deposit that into the postal system so that it gets delivered directly to a county or jurisdiction, which will receive it as if it has come from a voter. So now imagine that you have voting history files, which, let me turn this heat off, that you have voting history files that tell you whether a voter who is registered is active, whether they have voted, and you know whether or not they have voted. So in other words, every single voter that you could prospectively cast a ballot for, you know whether they're likely to go and cast their ballot in a given election. You have a potential likelihood, including, and this is a whole other aspect, if you have propagated the voter rolls and inflated the voter rolls with voter names, which are effectively personas like they have for bot farming. So these don't have to be real people who live in that state. They could be the names from another state that have been washed, laundered through, for example, Eric, and then injected into a state voter rolls, which helps explain why, you know, you had, for example, in Colorado between 2016 and 2018, three times as many new active voter registrations as you had an increase in state population. And from 18 to 20, you had four times as many as new population growth in the state. It's not possible. It's not possible to do that because the typical assumption is about 80% of new population is going to be eligible voting age population because you have some percentage which are children, some which are, you know, felons, some which are non-citizens, some which are registered in other states, some which are disabled somehow under guardianship or whatever. And so to have even 100% of your new eligible population appear on your voter rolls would be extraordinary and suspect. To have 200% would be ridiculous. 300% is crime, right? It's crime. And so when you have large, when your percentages of of when your numbers of voting population increase dramatically in an exceedance of your population growth. And then you have similarly the percentages of turnout of active voters staying the same or even going up, you know something's wrong. Well, this is how you do, this is how you could do that. I don't know for sure this is what's being done. You could also have people hand marking ballots that are fake, but or that there are not eligible voters and in other people's names. But anyway, this is one way you could do it. So this is what I want to show you, what it would look like. The difference between a wet ink signature and an inkjet printed signature. If our election judges had instruments, which they should have. So you couldn't go into a court and have an expert witness testify as to the authenticity of a signature unless that expert witness was an actual expert. They would have to be someone, if they're a credentialed question document examiner, they have typically a bachelor's degree in a science, frequently a physical science. They have typically at least 6 months of experience underneath the supervision of a credentialed expert in the field. They have to have passed tests and demonstrated that they have a certain amount of knowledge. And the more typical training requirements and experience requirements are a year of training and 2 years of experience before they would be considered an expert that you would want to cite and use in a court case for signature verification. So let me show you what these look like. So first of all, I want to show you a wet signature. Let me see if I can share my screen. That was the wrong way. Let's see, how do I share the screen? Open the share tray and then pick a window. Here we go. Let me zoom in on this a little bit.
We don't see your screen, Sean.
I'm just getting to it.
Okay.
Apologize for my incompetence and lack of proficiency. How's that now? Can you see it?
Yeah,
we can see it now.
Okay, so this happens to be a loop out of one letter in my signature. And what we're looking at it here, I'm going to zoom in. Can you see it zooming in?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, good. So this is one loop. Now remember, on an affidavit signature, it's typically about half an inch is the height, and it's the height that limits the size of the signatures on affidavits for ballot envelopes. It's typically about half an inch in height. That's about a little bit less than the size of a dime. Keep in mind here, this is already, you're looking at this. This is a 45 magnification image of a wet ink signature on paper that I scanned at very high resolution and high color. And now you're looking at it at about 10 times the size that you would be able to see it as if you were a signature verification judge working in a voting center. Now I'm going to zoom it in to what you can see if you look at it full screen. So you can start to see now the pixelation, and these are artifacts of the scanning originally, not of the wet ink signature itself. But I want you to just look and see, you don't see different, I'm gonna zoom in a lot here. I apologize, it's like when a dog gets right in your face. This is what my dogs do all the time. So you have variants of color here, but it's relatively fluid. You can see there's a harder line on the outside. That's an artifact. There's same thing here. That's an artifact of the pen itself. But you see tonal variations from lighter shades to darker, but it looks pretty continuous. Now I want to show you the same exact magnification and scan for an inkjet printed signature and watch what happens when you look at it. Do you see the pixelation inside? So you see lighter variants. You can see now color artifacts. It's a much different appearance at high magnification. Now this is just 45 magnification, which is very easy to do. These are cheap instruments. Now I'm gonna show you what 140 looks like wet. So this is a wet ink signature at 140 times magnification. This is very easy to do. You could have handheld devices. You could be doing this with an instrument that automates it. So this is a-
It looks like a Monet.
This is wet. Yeah, it does, right? And, and that's interesting that you say that because Monet used brushes for ink, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or brushes for probably oil painting or maybe acrylic or watercolor. I guess mostly
that's
watercolor.
That's in oil back then. He did a lot of watercolor, yeah.
Yeah, but he used brushes. And so when it's a natural analog created line, it's their color variations, but it's not like that there are repeatable, predictable, different colors in it. That color has been mixed, and that's the same with ink and pens. But now look at what an inkjet looks like under high magnification. Do you see the stark color variations, including the red and the yellow? It's really not technically, it's technically magenta, like CMK or something like that, CYMK. So you start to see these white spots that you did not see. And when you're at a more significant scanning, like it's impossible to miss the inkjet artifacts. And these, because it's spraying individual droplets onto the page, if you see individual yellow, this is the same exact color that has been scanned and then printed with the inkjet. But the way the inkjet reproduces that color of the original ink signature is by spraying a combination of different colored droplets. And at high magnification, you cannot miss the difference between these different color droplets. So again, let me take away and look at the wet ink. See, they're all tonal variations of the same mixed color, but when you look at the sprayed inkjet, you see the color droplet variations.
No, and Sean, those are both at 145 magnification, you said?
These are at 140.
140, okay.
These are at 140, and this is at 45.
Okay.
So let me throw up
the. Do you see a difference with the inkjet at 45, or does it have to be at that 140 to see the difference?
I think it's, so this is wet. This is the actual signature scan, and this is the wet again at higher magnification, and then this is the inkjet. Sorry, it's appearing in the wrong place. Hold on a second. Grab that. Whoop. Okay, so you can see the white spots in here that you do not see.
That's at 45?
That's at 45.
Oh, yeah. So you definitely can see at 45. Okay.
Yeah, so it's clearer at 140, but even at 45, you can see the difference with the color variations. I call them interstitials because there are these spaces in between. Those white space dots like this, like my cursor is right over this white dot, and then the flecks of red and the flecks of yellow, and the overspray pattern too.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's all past the actual loop. It's all over.
Exactly. Whereas in the same magnification, a wet, it does not have the same appearance at the borders. Like you can look at these two and you can see, I don't know if that is appearing, if both of them are side by side. But anyway, so
one's on top of the other, but you can see them both. Yeah.
So a machine detecting these things would be, it'd be child's play, right? Because it's already trying to scan it at higher resolution. The other problem here with signature verification, of course, is that now so many states are capturing signatures from wherever they get them. You have them in these unsecure voter registration databases that are, you know, not, they have no certification standards whatsoever, no testing standards. There's a federal statute under HABA that requires that the voter registration systems be secure and accurate. It is the law, but there is no enforcement mechanism whatsoever. There is no body enforcing it. There is no standard enforcement. There is nobody following up on it. It is essentially a blank check for inaccurate and unsecure voter rolls in states. And that's what we have. And we've proven that repeatedly in multiple states through canvassing. But part of that insecurity isn't just whether the individuals should be on there or their information is accurate. It is that the databases of signatures are completely and totally unreliable. We have no idea and no way of verifying as citizens whether the signatures in the database actually pertain to and are accurate for the voters that are listed, let alone where they've come from. So if I've got access to that voter registration system, I can inject whatever I want. If I want to have my dog's paw print be the signature that's verifiable for the Secretary of State of Colorado, I can do it. It's just an image. And then you have also all of these signature captures occurring at different state agencies with no verification really of the identity. So again, in states like Colorado, Nebraska, I think this is true in about 34 states, the signature or the identity verification requirements for citizens are so weak, they might as well not exist. So if you can verify that you are a particular voter with a utility bill, and the public official has no way to verify that the utility bill is authentic, then it's a fake ID, right? It's a fake ID as much as the McLovin fake ID was for the guy in the movie Bad, right? It's completely and totally ludicrous. It's useless. So it's not just a utility bill, it's a canceled check. Again, they have no way of verifying that it's an authentic check. They don't even verify that the bank exists or that the government agency exists, let alone that that particular check is authentic or that the individual on is authentic. Then you have certificate of Indian blood. I was trying to make a point and I made a certificate of percentage of Indian blood for the Secretary of State and made her 100% Inuit in a briefing that we gave in 21. And it shocked some of the legislators, but it didn't change anything, right? They didn't go back and try to change anything. I handed one pretty senior state government official, I think, I don't remember if he was the attorney general or the secretary of state. I think he was the attorney general of a state. I handed him a utility bill for him that I had made up that would have allowed me to vote for him in their elections. And he thought I was joking. He had to pull up his own statute and verify it. And he verified it. And then he was, you know, looked kind of sheepish about it. But anyway, so we have this witch's brew of an unsecure system, weak ID that can be just totally fabricated, and then this verification process. And this is the basis of us accepting ballots in our elections. Then we have the additional problem of companies like Runback, which you can watch video. They do these dog and pony interviews with him and EAC officials where they're talking about, for example, election officials, you know, preparing themselves for the paper shortage. So the very same people who have pushed early and mail-in voting, which involves the use of massive amounts of paper for the envelopes, because you have to envelopes. Imagine now, if we just printed ballots for election day, the difference between that paper supply requirement and the paper supply requirement to put an envelope around that ballot on the way out and on the way back. It literally triples the amount of paper that's being used. Then you have
at least, right? Because I know at least, Sean, because in here in Colorado, there's also an instruction form that is like an 11 by 14 folded, right? It's like the double page folded in half, printed front and back, that goes out with
sample
it too.
Sample ballots, the blue books, right? You can register to vote online, but you can't look up the information for all the ballot issues and races online. No, they have to send out a like 15 page packet to everybody. It's ridiculous. But anyway, so this is our problem. Then now we get to the automatic signature. So judges, at least if judges, you would assume, I think, you know, reasonably, some of them are going to be honest people, right? Some of them are your neighbors. Some of them are normal citizens trying to do their duty. They probably think they're doing something good, right? They think that they're being diligent. They're looking at the signature. They're making sure it matches the signature in the system. What they don't understand and aren't told is that there's no security verification or, you know, confidence that anyone should have in the signatures in the system, that they're looking at them without instruments. And because they're all amateurs, they don't even know the difference, right? Like it's like if you ever come on somebody and they're trying to change a tire and they use the wrong tool, but they don't know it. That's what our signature verification judges are doing. But most of our signatures in our largest counties, which are determining the outcomes of elections in our states, right? Like in Arizona, no county matters but Maricopa. It's so large compared to all the other counties. In Colorado, what county matters other than El Paso, Denver, Boulder, Jefferson, Pueblo at the low end, Mesa down at the low end, Laramie, Adams, Arapahoe, Jefferson. So in some states, one county is completely determinative, like Los Angeles County in California is larger than all, but I think maybe like 18 states populations. Then you have San Bernardino County, you have massive counties in Georgia, massive counties in Texas, in Florida. All the largest counties are using automatic signature verification. There is no certification or testing standards whatsoever for the automatic signature verification machines. Most of them, including all of the Runbeck machines, are connected to public networks to get back to Runbeck and also to get access to the voter information and signature databases that they use for the comparison. And if they're connected externally and there's no independent security or certification on them, which if they even had it, it would be like the voting systems probably, which is a total farce. It's totally incompetent. Let me stop sharing for a second. If they had a security system and certification system, it would likely be as grossly inadequate and corrupt as the one we have for voting systems. But we don't even have that. We have nothing whatsoever. There is no independent oversight or control over these systems at all. Now, the political affiliations of those companies' executives and staff becomes hypercritical, because if they're not completely impartisan, if they're not completely honest, they are controlling our election outcomes. It doesn't matter who sends a ballot in. It doesn't matter who's in the voting center. It matters who can print a ballot and print a ballot signature and who can control the authentication of them. So now you consider what happened in Los Angeles County when the citizens tried to recall District Attorney Gascon. I think it's Gascon. I don't really care. But anyway, they tried to recall him, and they had, I want to say it was 30%, the highest number of any petition in history on record, 30% of signatures were rejected, which brought them down just below the threshold they would need to have a ballot petition measure make it to the ballot for recall of Gascon. Now, the critical importance of the signature verification process and the role of these companies becomes evident. We could specify an entire regime of processes for testing and certification and verification and monitoring and auditing of the automatic signature verification machines, but you would still have the problems of identity and the voter registration databases. So now it's one more imperative, one more reason why when we recommend clean voter rolls starting from scratch, held at the local level, controlled completely at the county or parish, with read-only copies given to states for deconfliction and verification, internal to the state and external to the state, and election day voting in person with a government photo-issued photo ID, and then hand counting paper ballots, now the reason becomes clear, because the amount of resources it would take, like there's over 3,000 counties in the United States. If every one of them used voting systems, it would immediately outstrip all of the capable cybersecurity personnel we have in the US workforce. They would have to do nothing but auditing of those voting systems every election to even have a chance to know what happened on the voting systems. That leaves nobody left over. We're already short. I'd say we probably couldn't do more than 200 counties at one time if we used all the capable cybersecurity personnel and they were all trained, all knew the same standard, had oversight. That's what it would take just to do the voting systems. There's nobody left to do signature verification systems. There's nobody left to do the voter registration systems. We don't have that number of personnel in the United States. And then we have this impediment and obstacle of the public officials who have been brainwashed, some of them, willingly, some of them with glee, right? People who whistled on the way into the gas chamber. But they've been convinced that this system is viable and secure. They've been told this repeatedly. You have idiots like Palmer up at the Election Assistance Commission, and I'm being charitable to call him an idiot and not a corrupt son of a bitch. These EAC commissioners and their staff and the National Association of Secretaries of State and election directors, and then the institutions like CEIR, Center for Tech and Civil, CTCL?
Center for Tech and Civic Life.
Civic Life, thank you. Yeah. So Pam Anderson's, you know, mothership. And then you have the lawfare people who are suing anybody who questions, trying to get lawyers, you know, disembarred. There's another term for that. Debarred. Disembarred sounds more
disbarred. I think it's disbarred. Disbarred.
Yeah, that sounds right. Thank you. Disembarred sounds, that's like what you do at the K-bar. So trying to get the attorneys disbarred, right? You have, so look at the lawyers involved and the people involved in Maricopa. In the first Lake v. Hobbs case, Stanley Tucci, that judge, was formerly with Bain and Brown. Bain and Brown became Perkins Coie. He never disclosed that conflict of interest. Perkins Coie's chair of their you know, nationwide, firm-wide committee was a junior associate alongside Tucci at Brown and Bain, or Bain and Brown. These people are all like tight with each other. The Coppersmith Brockelman people are all involved in the same process. Sambo Dole was an associate at Perkins Coie and then became Arizona's election director with no prior election experience, and now is with States United, which are the people who are the outside counsel supporting Hobbs in all of these cases, trying to defeat election integrity measures from candidates and citizens. So anyway, so that's our environment. I'm confident we will never have a trustworthy election with these systems because we don't have the resources nationally. We don't have the resources. If we stopped defending defense systems, financial systems, and other national security systems and did nothing but try to secure these electronic voter registration, signature verification, and voting systems, we still couldn't do it, and we'd be defenseless against everything else. So let me stop there. So based on that, I have no confidence in Runbeck. Then there's the, I don't know, I've been to their facility in Phoenix. I've seen their facility. It's a weird looking place for a paper company. They've got, you know, secure walls, relatively secure. They're not like really high or anything, but all the way around, they try to block the view so you can't see shipments going in and out. They don't even have a sign up that says they're Runbeck. Okay. They've got cameras on the entrances. They've got another facility in Tempe. They've got other facilities in other states. Like they had one in Colorado, up until the 3rd of November, 2020, it was an industrial park on the western edge of Denver, and then it disappeared. So I don't know what they're doing. I don't trust them at all. They say stuff that's just nonsense. They were part of the Maricopa cover-up in this last election. They came out and said, oh, we helped them figure it out. Thank you, you know, Maricopa County Board of Supervisors thanked Runbeck for all their help in identifying the problem with the fusers, which was the real problem with the ballots. It wasn't the real problem with the ballots. More ballots were rejected because they changed printer settings on the ballot on demand printers and printed a 20-inch ballot image in a 19-inch space on 20-inch paper. That caused misfeeds galore with the ICP printers, and the ICP scanners in the voting centers. And there's a lot more going to come out about that in the next filing where they're trying to go to the Supreme Court in Arizona with that case, the one that was just dismissed with the second Lake v. Hobbs. So we could go into more detail, but let me open it up for questions and other comments, because I think there's a lot of experience now with the community of citizens in terms of these issues and what you're seeing in different states. So let me just stop talking and see who's got what questions and comments.
Okay, perfect. I can't help thinking, you know, as I'm listening to you, it sounds so similar to the Dropbox situation, right? Where it's like, no, we have this safeguard in place. We have these, you know, they're under surveillance, but the artifact on the video is terrible. No one is watching it. And you can't really, like, you can't do anything. Even when evidence is brought forth, like, look, this same person showed up over and over and over, like we saw in 2000 Mules. It's like, well, you can't prove it. So it's all these, like, you know, sort of placebos to soothe public that it's safe, but it's not.
The statute in Arizona, what is it, 16... I think it's 16503. So the statutes in Arizona revised statute requires, it's the law, right? This is the will of the legislature expressing the time, place, and manner restrictions required by the Article 1, Section 4 in the Constitution, the legislature prescribed the time, place, and manner of voting. It requires county boards of supervisors to have their ballots for an election printed and available for inspection 10 days in advance. Mm-hmm. It's the law. And what did they do in the vote centers? They relied upon ballot on demand printers to print for all those people voting in person. It was illegal. It was on the face of it illegal. It's a felony, literally a felony. Nobody's doing anything with it. The sheriffs aren't doing anything with it. The attorney general isn't doing anything with it. This is across the country. We are seeing this. The officials are violating the law rampantly. I mean, it's flagrant. So anyway, I said I'd stop. Let me stop.
That's okay, because I kept you going there. So David in Washington has been very patient. Go ahead, David.
Hi, everyone. Sean, you're spot on. We've got everything that you have mentioned and then some. My particular county, we actually run the Agilis, and my auditor is chomping at the bit to activate the signature verification. One thing that Sean didn't touch on is on these signature verifications, they're adjustable. You can set the tolerance to where a scribble counts as a signature. We've had an array of discrepancies from county to county, with some of our counties having up to 10,000 signatures that were kicked out down to as low as a few hundred. So we've got some major problems. One thing that we do and have said from the very beginning is, if you want to know what's coming to your state, simply look to Washington State and you'll see what's coming down the pipe. It's odd that you did mention Perkins Coie. Perkins Coie is currently in Washington State. We have a investigation. They have FOIA'd our public requests, a bunch of data from all 39 of our counties. We also have a case running simultaneously on that there is bias in the signature verification, and Perkins Coie is in Washington State as we speak trying to do away with signature verification because it's racist. This is a huge problem that we're trying to at least get some input on and some addressing of, but like this Agilis system, these aren't cheap. These are $500,000 machines. The other avenue that I wanted to kind of bring to your attention to is your postal service. It's a little dirty secret that within our United States Postal Service, we have a subsection that is only elections. They have their own postmaster general. They have their own sections that are secure, roped off, chain link fenced off with their own staff that the normal postal workers do not cross that barrier. We have discovered this here in Washington State and verified it with whistleblowers. They have their own machinery. Washington State is one of those lovely states where we have our signature on the outside of the ballot. So the Postal Service, and then we have identified that Runbeck is tied in with your voter rolls and through the ERIC database with the Postal Service. What Sean was saying about being able to duplicate your ballot is child's play for them.
Awesome. Did you have any question for Sean, or did you just want to share that?
That's perfect, David. I just want to add to what he said about the settings. Not only Runbeck uses, actually it's another Colorado product. It's funny, I always say this and it's true. Everybody says their state is the worst for election integrity and they're all 100% right. It's like reverse Lake Wobegon. But Colorado has also, unfortunately, been the exporter of a bunch of this bullshit. So the software, the algorithms, the approach to verification of signatures that's used by Runbeck for signature verification is produced by Periscript, which is a Colorado company. I can't remember if they're Thornton or Wheat Ridge, but it's theoretically it's used for like check signature verification. The problem is you can pick like in a thumbprint, you know, when you, if you ever look at thumbprint for biometric, you put your thumbprint down or you swipe it and the software is comparing a specified number of points, their spatial location. If you took the signatures on a pressure sensitive pad, you would have probably four times as much information to do signature verification on because they would be able to determine not just slant, stroke, and relationship, but also the pressure at each point in the signature. And you have a distinct pressure on your signature. So if they were doing that on a really high quality digital signature capture pad, you'd have that information, but that's not the case. And it's the same for signatures. Some of them are fuzzy. So you can change not only the number of points of comparison, and if you pick just one or two points of comparison, if it's like it picks a pixel in the middle and there's something filled in, it matches. You can also change gamma contrast and brightness settings for those scans, and each one of those has the perspective to increase or reduce the difficulty. So now imagine if I was like a hyperpartisan, you know, conservative, and I was responsible for controlling those machine settings, or I could do it remotely because I worked at Runbeck and I have a real-time connection to the system all the time. And I changed it so that any ballot coming out of a particular precinct, which happened to be heavily Democratic or heavily independent, would have much higher, more severe standards for signature verification than any ballot somewhere else. There'd be no record of it. Nobody looks at the logs. Nobody checks the configurations. Nobody is controlling this from a government perspective and verifying it from an independent perspective. So what David mentioned is super critical. These machines are wide open.
Bless you.
Gesundheit.
Thank you. Sorry.
One other thing on that, Sean, too, that you mentioned was this ability of the Runbecks to actually fill in the blanks, and they have duplicated different types of filling in the little circles. That actually, I personally have seen the script and the page where that shows up. And this was on the administrative laptops. When we were doing, my secretary or my auditor and the team, they like me, but they fear me. And so they have given me a few times to actually go in and witness things. I got to go see a machine count, which was an absolute joke. Don't get me started on that. But this was what they called a machine recount on a commissioner's race where there was only 33 votes separating them. As they were going through bringing up the votes, and all they did on this machine recount is count the undervotes, the overvotes, and the write-ins. They didn't actually count the votes for the candidates. But when I was sitting literally 3 feet behind her. When they were going through this, all of a sudden the screen popped up at the top of the monitor, and it had probably, I imagine there was 60, 80 little circles. And it started from a very dark, complete down to just kind of like somebody skimmed over it a little bit. And I called her on. I said, "What's that?" She goes, "Oh, well, that's a determining of the scoring of the ballot marking." And I said, "Well, I've never heard of such a thing." She goes, "Well, yeah, the machines actually have the ability, and in the batches, they go through and can actually score a filling in of the bubble." And the way it looked like, if you open up like Word or one of these where you have all of the command center across the top where you can click and set parameters on a document, exactly the same type of a setup. In my feeling that you literally could have gone up, clicked on one of these, carried it down, and put it on a ballot is the way it appeared to me.
Well, a couple graduate students at University of Michigan working under Halderman actually demonstrated that. that they could run a very simple script, a software program that would copy ballot marks, that they could basically take a snapshot, if you will, of ballot marks on a ballot image in real time as the ballots were being scanned, and then reproduce that ballot mark in a different location, and that there was sufficient information for the software to do it automatically. In other words, it would be indistinguishable to the naked eye, the final image that was retained in the machine as the ballot record. So the ballot record in a machine is the ballot image plus any scan or tabulation of the vote marks that's correlated to the kind of map of that ballot image. And together those plus the log records that prove when it was happened or try to prove when it was happened or correlate, that's all supposed to be part of the ballot record. So they showed that that could be done in real time as ballots are being scanned. There is no protection whatsoever on the scanning tabulating machines, none. That can be done. It's been demonstrated. It was years ago. You can find it. We've got the link. I think Amy may even have it in the library.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I do. I think if you search vulnerabilities, it should show up. All right, so next up we have George. Go ahead, George.
Thank you, Amy. It's a pleasure that you bring this together for us. Sean, I'm in Illinois, and we've got a basic system of voter registration and then the e-poll books. The e-poll books are much more accessible because they're not certified or even registered with the state. Now, within our e-poll books, the voter signatures are resident. They're not resident in the voter registration rolls. And what they do is they attach the voter ID, the specific ID for the state, go to the DMV and drop down a voter signature with a new coming, or they attach it in the e-poll book as a person signs up and registers. Now, my concern is there's very little access to the voting system. There's a hell of a lot of access to the e-poll books, and we're trying to figure out ways to be able to tie across the two together. Now, one of the things that we found was back in August of 2020, 20,000 driver IDs, driver's license IDs with Fitcher's signatures, addresses, names, and all that were confiscated by the border, the inspection people looking at things coming in from China. They found 20,000 of them. Now, my concern is if someone has access to these e-poll books, they can put all that information right up into it already. For anybody to print a driver's license with a signature on it, it's got all that data already compilated someplace. And so it's just a matter of uploading that information, possibly for a short period of time, such as 3 weeks before the election, and then removing it 3 weeks after the election. So we don't monitor the e-poll books, and we're trying to work with our county to be able to get into that process. We're concerned that that, and along with the mailing addresses, the voter registration requires a 5-digit zip code. The ballot tracking process requires a 9-digit zip code. And there's some concerns that the last 4 digits could be modified to go to a drop location. So we went with the postal inspector and talked to them about some of the information. And the postal inspector said that basically the delivered point is the central processing, which is like a central distribution center. It packages it for the local post offices. Now, certain packages go to the mail route where they're sorted. Other packages go to PO boxes and or businesses where they're not sorted. So the whole stack is just basically delivered without looking at the addresses. So our concern is more the poll books here in Illinois. The other thing is we're finding is the state of Illinois is starting to put together legislation for automatic signature verifications. They've already started backtracking on dual party signature verification on the outer ballot to as may be an appointed election official, which is going against the grain of having two people looking at it. Right now, technically, one person appointed by the election commission can verify signatures coming through on the ballots on the outside. That's our update here. One other thing is Dave Shistoka, constitutional attorney who ran for attorney general in the primary, a week and a half ago filed a suit in Will County. It's basically him and a couple of mathematicians come across an algorithm in one race. This algorithm, they were able to determine that the number of people that voted on election day versus the early vote and the vote by mail, and you put in a certain number and you can predict the precinct coming out. And they were able to predict every single precinct within, like, I think it was like 0.02%. And that because that 0.02% represented the provincial ballots and or the cured ballots that came in that they had to be cured after the fact that the other one's going in. We are not alleging a algorithm. What we're alleging is it's mathematically impossible for someone to predict the outcome of every single precinct for the county clerk and be able to be within that accurate. That's just a heads up. We're hoping something goes that way. They decided to stay away from admitting there was an algorithm, but rather saying that there's a mathematical improbability and that the voting system people have to explain this. That's my update in Illinois.
Yeah, that's exactly right, George, that it should be an entering argument where a rational judge says this has to be audited independently. Right, when you find that kind of a pattern. I also want to say something about the poll books. Electronic poll books are they are a fox in the chicken coop. I don't know if there are any chickens in the chicken coop in our voting centers and precincts, but there are a lot of foxes.
There's a bunch of sheep for sure.
Yeah. So when you look at the poll books, and we could talk about Asked and Robus, the company's name is Robus. It's Robus. Right. I don't know how clear more clear they could have been. But so No Ink, Asked, ESNSS poll books, they're all the same. They use tablets or laptops. 100% of the tablets and about 99% of the laptops have integrated hardwired wireless connectivity. You have just introduced a wireless networking connection into the voting center and put it next to typically voting systems. The tablets and laptops are almost 100% manufactured overseas, mostly in China, right? And then you see with the Einstein and with CIS's security system that they have put in to monitor, which began with Einstein, that they're using these cradle point routers, which are Internet of Things routers, all running on FirstNet, which is an unmonitorable, segregated wireless bandwidth used only for first responders, or only supposed to be used for first responders, controlled by AT&T and the FirstNet public-private partnership. So just like with ERIC, just like with CIS, FirstNet, by creating this public-private partnership, they have firewalled public scrutiny of what they're doing and what they have. And they do it underneath the rubric of this is critical infrastructure, the designation of election infrastructures as critical infrastructure in 2017. It has no advantages for Americans whatsoever. It only obscures access to information. So back to the poll books, I don't trust any of the poll books. We should not be using electronic poll books connected to anything or connectable to anything. I wouldn't have a problem with a clerk using a computer system that was completely self-contained within their voting center, but it would be an extraordinarily difficult task, much harder than just printing off paper voter rolls. So anyway, thanks, George. I appreciate you talking about that. We should probably have a
session. Yeah, I have one other
the e-poll books later.
I agree. Yes.
Yeah, I got one other question for you. Sean, can I ask you a question?
Sure, fire away.
Are you familiar with the logic and accuracy testing that's done on all the machines prior to the election?
I'm familiar with the farce of logic and accuracy testing, yes.
All right. Yeah. I have found that in the city of Chicago, on election day, they fire up their tabulators and put a modem on there, and they download a file. And I was wondering if this violates their logic and accuracy testing because they've now downloaded another file into the system that would change whatever the system is doing. Do you know if there's a strict requirement that once the logic and accuracy testing is done, that nothing can be done until after the election?
I'll have to look at the Illinois statute logically. So the election administrators are, you know, and I mean, this is, I mean this without any denigration at all, wildly, wildly ignorant about cyber, right? So they are among the most ignorant people in the country about cyber tech and security. They have no idea what they're downloading. They open that system up. They can be told it's anything. I'll give you, for example, Dominion voting systems down in Maricopa have language loaded on them for the audio files. It's a QM file for the Keras language. The problem with that is twofold. One, their software doesn't use QM files for their audio. That's not what Sepstral Voices uses. It uses an entirely different kind of file structure. And the second problem is Keras is a language spoken only by the Karasan people who live only in New Mexico. It's a indigenous population, tribal population, and they don't have any in Arizona. So nobody there ever questions any of that. Nobody questions any of this anywhere from the election administration standpoint. They don't have the expertise and they don't have the will. So they shouldn't be downloading anything into any system. It shouldn't be open or connected to any outside network. They have no ability to protect it. The fact that they allow it tells you either how corrupt or ignorant they are.
Yeah, it's not attached to a network, it's attached to a phone modem. They actually, in their instructions to the tabulator operators to plug it in right as they're setting it up, and then after it goes through the self-check and does the printing of the zero run, the modem then kicks in, brings in a file, and downloads that file into the same location that they, it looks like the same location that they did on the logic and accuracy testing when they did that.
Yeah, that'd be like, I don't know if anybody's ever canned food, you know, with mason jars, but that'd be like canning food, sealing it up, and then opening the top to stick your finger in to see if it was, you know, sealed up. You just, right, it's like Talladega Nights. You just ruined everything, right? If you open it up, there's no security at all. You have no idea what's been done. 2 seconds and you can download a file or command that radically changes the configuration, security, and performance and function of that system. It's a complex computer system. It takes no time at all. One connection and it's done. I'll look at the statute.
Okay, thank you for your help.
I can see on it. You bet.
All right, Sean, we have
some. All right, thanks.
Thanks, George. We have some questions, comments, etc. In the chat, Erica had said Perkins Coie is who filed the court case about signature verification here in Washington. Lori in Texas posted a link about Supreme Court rules unanimously you may sue government agents for damages when they violate your individual rights. Let us know how that goes. Doug in Montana said The excuse used to rely on machines is convenience. We must begin to focus on removing all third parties from our election process. Agreed. I could have sworn I saw some questions in here. Here we go. I do agree, Sean. I think having a whole research roundtable on e-poll books would be excellent and very beneficial. Burl says, can e-poll book data be used to insert illegal ballots? Hence, if there is a network connection to identify votes cast by registered party, then potential to insert ballots for those who registered and did not vote.
Yeah, 100%. This is why there's a great debate taking place right now. We've repeatedly, COA, me a lot, have told people repeatedly, do not vote early, do not vote by mail, vote in person and do it on election day. Well, they had the catastrophe in Maricopa, which was, I think, a designed intentional catastrophe. And so now a lot of people, including people I really respect and like Dan Bongino, are propagating the idea that everybody should early vote. You know, Scott Pressler's talk about, we're going to out ballot harvest them. No, you're not. You cannot outprint corrupt people. Mm-hmm. Right. So you may be out trying to collect legitimate votes from legitimate voters. You're working on turnout and engagement and getting them involved, and you're going to get the troops rallied. And you're going to go collect. You know, you could have 100% of conservative and independent voters all cast their votes, all vote responsibly for, you know, people from my perspective who, you know, whatever they want. But I think, you know, limited government, obviously constitutional government, and still at a, you know, an industrial park 4 minutes away from a voting center or the central count facility, you can have industrial presses and the envelope, you know, folders and the printers afterwards with access to the voter registration database, looking to see who has voted and who is unlikely to vote, and printing out for every ballot you collect, they can print 10. Mm-hmm. You cannot outprint corrupt people. You have to end the possibility.
Not without breaking the law, right?
No, you have to end the possibility of people being able to inject fraudulent votes and ballots and voters into the process and counts. The only way we do that is by getting rid of the machines, because we don't have the resources nationally to supervise and audit them. And they're not secure to begin with, and they can't be made secure. So yeah, there's 100%, and that's what we're concerned. This is also why I go back to like ballot tracks and IVMTR. That's what it's called in the USPS, IVMTR. When you have that feedback about who has received a ballot, which has been undeliverable, which have been returned, you have a 90 to 94, 95% probability of being able to accurately predict and model just from those your voter turnout and votes for top line races. So if you're trying to control or determine the outcome of an election, all you need to know is what are coming in, and it gives you, it's like being able to see the future, right? After these ballots arrive at the tabulation centers, you're going to know what the counts are. Now, if you have the ability to inject fraudulent ballots or to manipulate the count, you know exactly what you have to do that. You know your baseline that you're starting from.
Awesome. Sean Edie in Massachusetts is saying, in Massachusetts, we don't use Runback. Do you know of other printing companies who do what Runback does?
Yeah, actually, there's one in Washington State, and there are others. There's another one in, Illinois has one of the printing companies, the large ballot printing companies. There's another one down in Florida. I could, in the back of... I think it's in the back of Dominion's functionality description, and then some secretaries of state have approved lists based on them having been approved by particular voting system companies. You can find the lists of the printers. While we're talking, I'm looking at the election statutes for Illinois, but let me pull that up because I think that's a quick one. So while we move on to the next question, I'll see if I can pull that up.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah, I was looking at that too. Okay, so this is a question that actually a friend of mine recently asked me when she saw the post on social media about Ruth McGregor in Arizona leading the independent investigation about the printer issues in Maricopa. And her question is, okay, so if Maricopa appointed this chief justice and to see why the printers – that read the ballots had trouble reading some of the ballots. Like, is this all just wordplay since the printers don't read the ballots? That's, and this is somebody who's not involved in election integrity at all. And she's asking me, okay, but the printers don't read them, right? That's the scanner. So is this just another nonsense, quote unquote, investigation or what?
Well, I haven't looked into the appointment. I know she was appointed. I don't know who. So she's been appointed a special master, right? Let me just pull that up.
What she sent me says, former Arizona Supreme Court Chief Justice Ruth McGregor will lead independent investigation into Election Day printer issues. This is from Maricopa County's, which I think is why she didn't trust it, because it was from Maricopa County's, I don't know, Twitter or Truth Social or something. I can't tell what she pasted the screenshot from, but it's definitely their social media account.
Okay, yeah. The Chief Justice of the Arizona Supreme Court, Birch, announced that she was appointing the special master, the former. I don't know. I have, I think I've said it before, as a officer, as a former officer, I don't have the luxury of requiring any external encouragement or relying on hope. That's kind of, if you lead, it's your job to generate it, not to look for it. So, but I have no confidence in the judiciary at this point. So having the court appoint somebody and having them pick one of their own cloistered, robed colleagues, whether she's retired or not, I don't have a, you get the exceptions, right? You get somebody like Gableman who'll just lay it out up in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of requires an egotist because they have to value their own sort of word over their reputation and over their status and acceptance within their community. So I don't know McGregor. I don't know what the chances are that McGregor is going to do a legitimate investigation, but we'll know when we see who she involves. If she asks for independent forensic experts, many of whom are the ones who've been willing to be involved, we already know the names of guys like Parikh and Dr. Doherty and Ben Cotton and those kind of people. If she asks for them, then we'll have some hope that it'll be a legitimate investigation. And if she doesn't, then it's probably whitewash.
Okay. So we just kind of have to wait and see with that. Got it.
Yeah, we'll know soon enough. I mean, the guy's going to the Lake v. Hobbs trial team is going to press to go to Supreme Court, and they've got a lot of more evidence to introduce. They're going to ask for independent forensic examinations.
All right. Okay. So Sean, I see you dropped that link in the chat, and Erica says K&H Printers is who does it in Washington. All right, and I see Adam has a hand up. Go ahead, Adam.
Hey, thanks for having me on. Sorry, I'm running the kids around. I haven't been able to be on the whole time. This is a little bit off topic. I'm looking for anybody in the group who has some granular data regarding Seidel and Edison aggregate vote totals that are under my suspicion or getting through the Secretary of State's office. And the kind of the background to this is if anybody has looked at these Excel spreadsheets that give the batch updates, the corresponding batch percentage equals the running total percentage of each candidate, 30 to 60% of the time, depending on the state. And this is from the 2020 election. I'm bringing this forward to my county and hopefully in Florida, the state, but I need to get, I guess, some more data on how that feed works from the Secretary of State to Seidel and or Edison. And I'm wondering if anybody in the group has worked on this data.
I see Lori has a hand up. Lori, have you worked on that or did you have a different question?
No, but I know somebody that works on that. Todd Lindstrom in Collin County created lostvotes.us, which deals with the totals from the county going to the Secretary of State and how those numbers are never the same. And so he'd probably be a good person to get connected with.
Okay, let me go
Adam,
go ahead.
There's a data working group Jeff Young is helping coordinate that. There's a lot of good people in it. They connect with sometimes, not all the time, but with like Jeff O'Donnell and Draza. They're, you know, also work with it's right on the tip of my tongue now, NCOA.
Yeah, I spoke with Jeff for 2 hours the other night, and
okay,
I did get some granularity with it. If I remember from a call on here a few months ago, there was someone who had really looked into the internal Edison process, and I can't remember his name. And it seemed like he had a lot of information I can't seem to remember.
Well, I mean, I know that, yeah. So Jeff Young will know those guys, but I know Jeff Young and Draza and Doc Daugherty have all looked at it because they were initially trying to use the Edison data for modeling prior to them getting access to CVR. If they can't answer your questions, they'll know who's done the most work on it. I've done some research into CIDL, but it was more about the history of the company. I mean, CIDL is effectively controlling the largest election software vendor in the United States. SOE is the largest election software in use. So.
Yeah, and out of all the exhibits in terms of evidence, I feel like this is the most compelling, and this is the reason I'm running it to ground. It is because everyone can understand it. And the fact that Edison and CIDL match completely is just further proof that these aren't internal mechanisms that are reporting this. They have to be coming from the Secretary of State office, even though if they, you know, like CIDL puts on its website, it gathers via exit polls and stuff like that. That's a lie. They wouldn't be able to get this granularity and this exact data if that was the case. And it wouldn't match with, you know, Edison if that was the case. So I think it's a compelling piece, but I need to be able to answer the mail when I bring this to the county commissioners, you know, well, how do you know this is valid? And I have to be able to, you know, look at the process from A to Z to the best that I can.
Have you ever read Vote Scam?
No, I have not.
So Vote Scam is fascinating because they talk about this issue of the data getting to the news, or the reported data getting to the news, and it not having an actual legitimate connection and correlation to data coming off the machines. So a lot of precincts or jurisdictions, counties, for example, in Colorado, they upload their election results, their unofficial results, directly into Clarity Election Night reporting, and then somehow that data is being transmogrified and becomes appears on the screen. But we've had documented instances where what was on the screen is not what the counties uploaded. I think it's happening a lot and counties just aren't catching it. And then you have the whole mechanism of the centralized scanning of particular ballots, like early voting, where the precincts won't even know, or the vote centers won't even know about votes being attributed to them that aren't necessarily legitimate. So it's pretty clear that's being manipulated, but Vote Scam talks about how far back this goes. It was fascinating for us because I found out from Vote Scam that League of Women Voters has been involved in the generation of, you know, fraudulent voters and voting statistics for a long, long time. I thought they just got involved recently because they were part of the lawsuit against us in Colorado, where they alleged we were violating the KKK Act, which is, of course, ludicrous and false. And we've now pretty effectively demonstrated that in court. They've been destroyed. So they're about to find out what kind of damages we're looking for their actions. And we want to dissuade them from ever doing it to anybody again. But you should check out the book Vote Scam. It's available. Okay. I think you can find it almost for free, if not for free. So,
okay, I will. And just circling back, what was the name of that website? One of the ladies on the call here mentioned it was voteswitching.us. Can you clarify that again?
It is lostvotes.us. And if you send me your, I'll put my email in there, send me your email and I'll make you an introduction for you.
That would be great. Okay. I'll put that in the chat and I'll look for your email.
I just dropped the link in the chat. So it's there now.
Okay.
Perfect. And Edie found, go ahead.
Now I'm going to lose connection here in about a minute, but thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. And I see Edie found Massachusetts printer DS graphics. DS. Funny. Yeah, sorry. So yeah, see the link there. Go ahead.
I knew it, that was a printer. I just didn't know if they did the same shenanigans that Runbeck does. Or if
oh, I see. Like Sean, others. Do you know?
Yeah.
I don't, but I'm sure there are smaller vendors that literally just print legitimate ballots. But it's also...
Their homepage, you know, does say solutions in marketing, print, mail, fulfillment, and everything in between.
So just because of, you know, the normal ballot, that here's the other problem, right? And so we saw this in Maricopa with the 2020. Maricopa should have only had two types of ballot paper. The ballot paper that came from the HP Industrial PageWide presses, which is off those massive 1,000-pound rolls that Weyerhaeuser or International Paper ships to them. And then whatever printer paper they were using, which was specified and delivered to them for their ballot on demand printers, if they had to print replacements in the voting centers, those should have been the only two kinds of paper. I forget if they found 11 or 13 kinds of paper when they did the paper examination. Why did that happen? Our suspicion is it happened because they created the election results they wanted, created the ballot images, which they can do automatically on the machine. That's, you know, an output of the adjudication software, is it puts out a ballot image that has been amended to show the voter marks that adjudication has determined whether it involved a judge or not. So they imagine that you have, you know, a whole server stood up with virtual machines running the scanner software, and they are creating from the cast vote record ballot images that match the cast vote record for the results that they want. Now you just have to print them. But it's a lot of ballots to print. 2 million ballots is a lot of ballots to print. So if you print them in multiple locations or even in one with whatever paper you've got, and that's your, now those are your new ballots that you're going to use as your, you know, as your official record that you then replace whatever ballots you had before with, you're going to have a lot of different types of paper. So it might not just be the official ballot printer. It might be whoever's printing ballots that are being used to represent the election results that were predetermined, if that makes sense.
All right. So we're almost out of time, but I know, Lori, you've had your hand up forever. Go ahead, Lori in Texas.
Oh, hey, y'all. Thank you for everything. No, I was just responding. I was responding to something else. So we're fighting for the ballots in Texas. The ballot images, there's four states, Florida, Arizona, Texas, and New Jersey, that have lawsuits to restrict the ballot images requested after 60 days. And so our county sued the Attorney General of Texas. After he said they had to give them to us, they said, no, we don't. And they've sued him now. So we are battling for records right now. And we do have some movement on a sergeant with the Attorney General's office going out to a couple counties and investigating some of the ES&S issues. So that's kind of just an update from Texas, and great to hear everybody working. Thank you, everybody, for caring enough to learn and improve our situation. Thank you, Sean.
Yeah, amen. Nothing is over until we say it's over. That's how this government works. And they don't believe it now, but they'll believe it when we're done. So don't give up. We don't know how long it's going to take, but we know the outcome in the end.
We just got to flex the Constitution a little bit. It takes a little time.
That's right.
Yeah. Frank, did you have a question? I feel like your hand was up earlier and I may have screwed up and lowered it, or maybe you changed your mind. I just wanted to make sure we didn't miss you. Nope. Okay. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. So it looks like we're ending right on time. Thank you, Sean, for being here. You guys want to continue this discussion next time and bring in e-poll books? Does that sound good with everybody? So that will be on Wednesday, January 25th. Same bad time, same bad channel. All right. Thanks for being here, everybody. Have a good week.
On the data question, by the way, I saw Rick Yost. I saw a post it. I didn't realize Rick was on here. Rick is the perfect person to talk to about the data group. So
yeah, Rick is always on here, like faithfully. Yeah.
I didn't even realize. I would have just turned me talk, like it's me talking about it while he's here is like a waste of everybody's time because he's going to be more authoritative in terms of talking about what they've researched in data and who the right person is to talk to. But if you can't reach Rich, Jeff Young can connect you, or Jeff O'Donnell can connect you. And why can't I think of his name that does NCOA? Oh, Russ Gao is NCOA. So all those guys I talked about. The Seidel and Edison data, and some of them, you know, focused on it more than others. So, but if you can't figure out the right person, you know, come back to us and we'll make sure you get connected.
Perfect. All right. Thanks, everybody. Have a great rest of your week.
Take care.
Bye.